Welcome to History Lessons, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast featuring the world's leading historians answering the big questions, hosted by Matthias Hesseris.
In the summer of 1944, the liberation of Western Europe was underway. Over 150,000 Allied troops had landed on the shores of Normandy in the largest seaborne invasion in history. It is remembered by many in the West as the beginning of the end of the Second World War. And the sacrifices of those who died are commemorated by world leaders today. But it could be said that this was a sideshow to the much greater sacrifice taking place 1,000 miles east. 3 years earlier, on the 22nd June 1941, over 3 million Axis troops invaded the vast frontier of the Soviet Union, in a gamble that allowed Hitler's powers to extend to within miles of Moscow. Operation Barbarossa was the largest land invasion ever seen, and one of history's greatest betrayals. To Western eyes, D-Day was the day of judgment, the turning point that sealed the fate of fascism in Europe. But Jonathan Dimbleby, one of Britain's greatest broadcasters and historians, wants to set the record straight. In his book, Operation Barbarossa: How Hitler Lost the War, he shows that it was the Eastern Front that sealed Hitler's fate, and at a human cost that continues to shock the world. Jonathan, thank you for joining me. Operation Barbarossa is remembered as the titanic struggle of the war. Hitler's decision to invade the Soviet Union in 1941 opened up the Eastern Front, leading to the famous battles at Leningrad and Stalingrad. To what extent was the decision premeditated?
Intellectually and psychologically, in Hitler's mind, it was long premeditated. He'd written about it in Mein Kampf, the need for Germany to recover from the humiliation of Versailles, which involved, among other things, the need to restore the rightful borders of a great German nation, a great Aryan people. And that required living space, Lebensraum, to the east. It combined with an urge to destroy the great Satan of Bolshevism and to eliminate from Europe, by whatever means might prove appropriate, the Jewish people. So there was a tripartite urge: Bolshevism, the Jews, and Lebensraum. And that was embedded deeply in him. So the question was only about when to go and how to go, not whether to go.
Did Hitler always want this fight as a sort of defining battle?
I think that he thought not so much that it would define him, but that the battle itself would define the future of Germany, because he had allowed himself to believe, and indeed a great many of his senior commanders had allowed themselves to believe, that it would be all over in a matter of weeks. You had an Axis forces of 3.3 million people, and it was going to be a knife through butter. It was going to be as it had been in the West with the conquest of the lowlands.
Yes.
and France. So there was never doubt in his mind, and indeed it was widely believed in London and in Washington as well, that it would be over very rapidly, and then he would be master of Europe, and at that point the British would be bound to come to terms, and almost certainly the United States would keep out of it. That was his wrong-headed set of assumptions.
The invasion was a betrayal of many years of alliance. So 2 years earlier, as Hitler prepared to invade Poland and then France, he and Stalin signed a Molotov-Ribbentrop pact to keep the peace. Why was this pact signed in the first place?
It was an opportunistic pact and very complicated. It's history. It emerged from a long period of relations between Moscow and Germany, Moscow and London. And it originated, if you like, way back in 1922 with a secret treaty of Rapallo,
yeah,
at which the two sides in secret agreed a protocol to a treaty that's burst upon the world, while Lloyd George, just down the road in Genoa, was seeking to put together a new contract with Europe economically to deal with the consequences of the failure of Versailles. So there was always a relationship there between the two behemoths. There was a relationship went back to the 19th century and before. The two behemoths of Europe, the massive Soviet Union as it had become, with its vast numbers of people, its raw materials, and on the other hand, the most advanced European nation economically, financially, capable of utilising those resources of the Soviet Union very effectively and requiring them because it was also itself short of all those raw materials, not least including oil. So the relationship had been there. The question of the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact came after there was verbal fisticuffs, but as so often in international relations, verbal fisticuffs are but that. There was an underlying common interest. To this extent, Moscow was deeply suspicious of London and vice versa, and for very good reasons on both sides. They had been in constant bad faith negotiations. Simultaneously, as you got towards 1939 August, when the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was signed, you had a bad faith set of negotiations going on between Moscow and Berlin. The reason for it from the point of view of Hitler was at that point he thought that he could deal with Britain, that he could force Britain at least to the conference chamber to negotiate a settlement. He believed that the Brits and the Germans had so much in common that they couldn't possibly, the British couldn't possibly misunderstand that there was a role for Britain in the world alongside the role of Germany. That was not acceptable, at least once Churchill had come to power after the fall of the West in May 1940. And then there was the Battle of Britain, and he realised he couldn't actually take Europe, couldn't take Britain, and therefore he had to go into conflict first with the Soviet Union rather than tackle the Soviet Union afterwards. That was by 1940 and 1941. It was in 1940 in the summer that he actually first mooted the invasion which became Barbarossa. And it wasn't till the end of that year that he gave it the final go-ahead for what was to have been May 1941.
In terms of how Stalin looked at the pact, did he really believe that this was a proper pact in any sense?
No, it was just as opportunistic. It was a delaying tactic. Stalin had successfully decapitated his army after the Finnish War of 1939-1940. It was deeply demoralised. It was not prepared to conduct offensive war. And it was ill-equipped, ill-led, and it was filled with untrained or little trained soldiers. It was very large on paper, but enfeebled in reality. And he wanted to postpone the evil hour when he knew that it was very likely conflict would be coming, because he wasn't ready for it. So he allowed himself to believe, despite all the evidence, that it wouldn't happen, even when Hitler's armies were massing alongside his border. And he was getting intelligence of an extremely accurate kind from Japan, from Germany, and from France and elsewhere, that it was about to happen. He refused to allow his forces to go onto a war footing. The result was catastrophic when the invasion came.
But how do we explain that? How do we explain? So you say he should have seen it coming, in a sense. And still, what was going on around him? What's the context?
No one knows what was going on in Stalin's head. Whether he knew it was coming and it was inevitable and he could just postpone it, whether he allowed himself to believe that actually Hitler was game-playing, that all he was doing was upping the ante to get more resources from the Soviet Union. They were also, right up until the invasion, raw materials were going across the border. They'd signed in the early spring of 1941 a further trade deal. So then the trains were rattling back and forth between the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union border as created by the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, into Germany. And vice versa, Germans were in the Soviet Union. So I believe, on the basis of my reading, that you cannot read Stalin's mind clearly. All we do know is that he refused to contemplate reality.
Then what happens is that the invasion begins 22nd of June, and the first week was terrifyingly successful. And you describe the horrors of the Nazi advance in detail. Just how unprepared were the Russians for the Axis invasion?
Many of the Russian soldiers were on leave. Those who were at the front, 56 divisions out of 160-odd divisions only were near the Western Front. The reserve armies were not prepared. No planes were camouflaged on the airfields. Tanks and positions were being witnessed by the spotter planes of the Luftwaffe, photographed and taken back so that when they went into attack, they knew exactly where every airfield was, which absolutely destroyed thousands of Soviet planes, which was catastrophic because that eliminated a very important defensive arm if you're fighting a war on this scale. And the reports were coming back right up until the eve of the war from the front line, from deserters from the German side who were Bolshevik sympathisers on the one hand, and from those who they did capture. And again, don't take any action that might be constructed as a warlike act, because it could be used by adventurist commanders on the German side to precipitate a war. I know that we can hold the line, and goodwill messages were sent until the very last moment when it totally collapsed, and the German ambassador goes to see Molotov and says, sorry, we're at war with you. And Ribbentrop sees the Soviet ambassador and says the same thing. And then Ribbentrop, being an extremely unpleasant, oily character, affects to be very dismayed. Whereas I think the German ambassador in Moscow was genuinely horrified at what was happening.
And Stalin himself is almost shocked when it happens, right? I mean, he retreats to his dacha and sort of leaves for a while. There's no messages going to the people at all. He doesn't speak to Russian people.
He seems to be shell-shocked.
Yeah.
He leaves the Kremlin, goes to his dacha, as you say, and no one can make contact with him. And there's speculation about his motive for doing that. Was it because of this ghastly thing that had happened? Was it that he could not think clearly, did not know what to do? Or was it more cunning? Mm. Was it to ensure that the Politburo would still be behind him? And as it happened, dutifully, a while later, the Politburo turns up and says to him, Comrade Stalin, we want you to lead us out of this. And he then returns. But the first broadcast news of what had happened, and there are images of in Moscow of Russian citizens standing in the streets listening to the loudspeakers, which are of course in squares and main streets to broadcast Soviet propaganda most of the time. They're hearing the voice of Molotov, who was not a gifted communicator. His nickname, incidentally, was Old Stonearse. No one's ever quite sure whether that was because he was so obstinate, as indeed he was, in negotiation, or whether he got kicked so much by Stalin that his backside was made of stone. And he gave the announcement, and of course the Russian people were appalled. In a dictatorship of that kind, you rely entirely, because of the suppression of people's rights, entirely on your secret police to find out what's actually happening. They were seriously concerned that there would be a great deal of disaffection. Would they have the loyalty of the Soviet people to fight this patriotic war, as it later became called? And there was a great reassurance when most people shared the view that the fascists had to be stopped, although certainly in Ukraine and elsewhere, there was a great deal of sympathy because of their abhorrence of what Stalin had done to their country. There was a great deal of sympathy for the Germans.
6 weeks into Barbarossa, this is a strategic crisis in the Nazi high command. Hitler decides to halt an attack on Moscow, redirecting his panzer divisions to Crimea, the so-called breadbasket of Europe. I think that's important to mention. That's part of why this operation happens in the first place. So why did he do this, and how costly was this decision for the campaign?
It was fundamentally costly. He had recognised, because the Russians had resisted with such tenacity, had fought hand-to-hand rather than surrender, even when they were encircled, tens of thousands, soon hundreds of thousands of them encircled, they fought rather than surrender. And I think that was, it's clear, for two reasons. One is the terror of not fighting. Their own families would have suffered. They would be regarded as cowards, traitors, deserters. merely for doing what any democratic army would do under those circumstances, saying we can't fight any longer, we're surrounded by huge firepower and we'll just be mown down. And also from a feeling of real patriotism. This is our land that's being invaded. These are our farmsteads, our villages, our towns that are being razed, and we have to fight. So they fought much harder. It became clear that the original three-pronged attack, three army groups, one to the north, to Leningrad, one to Moscow, one to the south, Kiev, Ukraine, and onwards, that you couldn't do it all at once. The army generally, I mean, the very high command, Keitel and others immediately around Hitler were just satraps. But those who were thinking at all strategically, they wanted to go to Moscow. They believed that if they could go to Moscow, defeat the Red Army outside Moscow, Bolshevism would collapse, it would be game over. Hitler was very concerned. I touched earlier on the lack of natural resources. Very concerned to get the natural resources of the Donetsk region, iron ore, all sorts of other precious metals required for warfare. He was after the oil of the Caucasus, because Germany had no oil of its own, no oil resources of its own. And he thought that was more important, to secure that. And then once you'd destroyed the wealth of the Soviet Union, taken it, plus the alleged huge value of the rich soil of Ukraine, the black earth soil, which is like very deep soil, very, very fertile, there wasn't nearly as much of it available as people believed in Germany, but they had a hunger plan, which was designed in order to take all of this land. The official hunger plan would require the death of 30 million Soviet citizens because they would be starved out of their lands. That never came to fruition because of what happened. But the impact of the need for that meant that Hitler said, right, we're going to go south. The army resisted. So there was a full-scale conflict. At this point, Hitler was not in relation to his army commanders. He was not demonic. His goal was demonic.
Yeah.
But he didn't ignore them and say, off with his head. Unlike Stalin traditionally had said, off with their heads if they disagree with him. So he dithered, and there was a month of dithering. And during that dither, although the Soviets were still retreating, they were able somewhat to regroup and to re-establish defensive lines. Now, there's big historical debate whether Hitler was, as it were, strategically right or wrong. And you can argue that for the rest of time. But that's what happened. And the result was that the struggle slowed. What had been a blitzkrieg became far more of a trudge. And there was the long logistic lines, troops getting tireder, getting into autumn, bad weather. And it was beginning to look, from the frontline commander's perspective, let alone the soldiers, however strongly they believed in the Nazi ideology, and a lot of them did, far more difficult than them being told it was going to be at the beginning.
The Germans was also, they were amazed how tough the Russians fought. And I think it's interesting, you have a lot of that in your book. I mean, the source material is actually quite extraordinary. All the letters that were sent home, and they're quite candid gives you a pretty full picture of what was going on. Can you say something about that, the perception of what they encountered?
It was soldiers, the ordinary soldiers, and some of the commanders had allowed themselves to believe the Nazi propaganda, that the Slavs were subhumans, that they did not really belong to the human race, as were regarded the Jews in an even more acute form. But the Slavs did not count. So they were disgusting lower life creatures who ought to have crumbled. And when they didn't, it was a source of amazement and admiration in the case of a lot of those German soldiers who weren't quite so absorbed in the notion that they were dealing with less than human people. And they recognized with a degree of awe. And you have generals, like a very outstanding general called Heinrici, who was a general of an infantry division, went on to become a very good, highly regarded historian of war. He survived it all. You see his shift of attitudes. It's all going to be a walkover. It's all going to be... And then suddenly, they're fighting. And the chief of staff of the army, Halder, point noting how ferociously they were fighting. And this was not good for the morale. This is a lot more difficult than we thought it was going to be. Are we going to get to Moscow? What do we do when we get there? And all the time, the days are ticking by and people are getting tireder and tireder. I think the essential thing they discovered was that the Soviet soldier was someone to be frightened of, as indeed the Soviets regarded the German soldiers, which is why the conflict became so barbaric. It was brutal, barbaric, murderous in a way that no other conflict in the Second World War was. I mean, the brutalization, the destruction on and off the battlefield, the killings of people arbitrary, the shootings in the head, the arresting people and then shooting them before trial, all in defiance of what both sides had ignored, the existing Geneva conventions. A hideous and very, very bloody campaign, which actually when you're reading it, I find myself wanting to avert my gaze the whole time. I didn't, because I think it's really important to understand what it was like. But it is pretty dreadful to read. And people veered from, on the one hand, thinking now of the Germans, on the one hand, we killed a lot of people, we shot them up. On the other hand, almost in the same breath, saying these people can really—they can really fight. They can really fight.
So we'll get back to the atrocities, because this is—it's one of the most brutal campaigns that history has ever seen. It's extraordinary, harsh. But before we get there, we're trying to get a timeline here. So late in 1941, the crisis deepened in German high command. Top officers threaten resignation. Hitler's commands get more deranged. Within 6 months, you say, by the end of 1941, the Nazis had lost any realistic chance of winning the war. Is this the point of no return for Operation Barbarossa?
Yes. There are those who argue quite persuasively, if not totally convincingly, that in fact you can trace that statement right back to the hiatus in August, the indecision, that it was clear from then that it was not possible to achieve the victory that was required. But certainly by the end of December, in my view, and I think held quite widely, the Barbarossa and the whole project of the invasion on the Eastern Front was doomed. Anthony Beaver, in his great book on Stalingrad, writes that if the Battle of Moscow was the military turning point, Stalingrad was the psychological turning point. And I think that is probably a very good way of putting it. Militarily, it was not possible. I also think that psychologically, the passion had gone out of the struggle, except for those who were so suborned by Nazism that they believed that anything was possible because Hitler had said it was.
So much of this story is a lesson in hubris at the top. How do leadership styles of Hitler and Stalin differ?
At this point in the war, Stalin and Hitler were both the supreme commanders of their armed forces. So their decisions, their writ ran. Hitler was, despite advancing into eastern Poland and taking up living conditions there at Wolfschanze, his bunker there, and his high command was there, he was lamentably out of touch with what was actually happening on the battlefield, because he didn't want to hear it. Even when the commanders in front were sending back really honest accounts and trying to get them through, he was protected by his own inner group from the reality and just said, we can do it, we can do it. And because he had done it in the past, they believed him. And so he issued instructions. And when the levers came off in his hand, he found a new lever to pull. So he just went on. Stalin, fighting a defensive battle, had no choice but to rely far more on his commanders. He made dreadful errors, strategic errors. You know, he'd been warned, for instance, not to try and save Kiev. When the Germans had gone south in the autumn, General Zhukov, who was his greatest and most famous commander, said this is a nonsense, and he was sacked and removed and sent to another post until there's another crisis, of which Zhukov had to be called back again to save Leningrad, and then back from Leningrad to the Central Front. He overrode. He didn't execute. He executed some, but he didn't execute those. So he made dreadful strategic decisions. So there was a muddle on the Soviet side, but a massive readiness to pour more and more human beings into the front to perish in very large numbers. And that was fundamental. Hitler was equally indifferent to human life, but he had many fewer men on whom to call. And moreover, he was fighting, he was constantly attacking. And the defenders were in a much stronger position. They were nearer to their supply lines, and they had increasingly good weapons. The T-34 tank, which came on stream, was a fearful weapon that General Guderian, who was the supreme panzer commander on the Eastern Front, was truly frightened of. We are peppering with our tanks. Our panzers are peppering the T-34. We've got no not effective enough anti-tank weapons to take them out. So there was a sort of alarm at the front, and Hitler was absolutely indifferent to it. Stalin would have been indifferent, but actually there was much more unity because they were just retreating and dying, but fighting with great resilience.
I find it fascinating because, in a sense, Hitler's fate is sealed, if I understand your account correctly. So when we go into 1942, can you say that the war is already won for the Allies?
Not won for the Allies. Hitler could not prevail in the East. You have to remember by 1942, of course, that after Pearl Harbor, the Americans were in alongside the British, which massively changed the pressures on Hitler and the whole dimension, the dynamic. But regardless of that, even if that hadn't happened, because the aid didn't start to flow until well after 1941 in substantial measure, it's on to really 43, come 44, that became the Allied aid, the Lend-Lease became really important. And of course, the Allies weren't on the ground despite Stalin's increasingly intemperate demands that there should be a second front in Europe.
Yes.
Churchill refused that. The Americans would have been far keener to do it, but in my view, Churchill was right. Hitler was doomed. Now, what would have flowed from that is anyone's guess. Stalin was not doomed. Stalin would have been immensely powerful, as he turned out to be in Eastern Europe. Mm. An ally by that time of Britain and of America, but how long would that have lasted? What would have happened in Europe? Would there have been you could speculate, would there have been a Red Army struggle with the British and Americans for Western Europe? But that he could not win the war against Stalin, against the Soviet Union, by the end of 1941, in my view, is evident.
This is a conflict that spared no one, and some of the most difficult passages in your book are about the treatment of civilians and especially Jewish people. The testimony of survivors is shocking to read. Why was the Eastern Front so particularly savage?
The subhuman characteristics of the Slavic peoples, the hatred of Jews, the license given to Himmler and under him to Heydrich and their henchmen to establish these four Einsatzgruppen and task forces who followed behind to clean up the Lebensraum territories. Cleaning up began by identifying anyone who could be thought to be a commissar, either formerly a commissar or associated with a commissar or sympathetic to Bolshevism as an enemy, and sometimes with a kangaroo court, sometimes instant execution, killing them. Jews were identified very swiftly as being commissars, and commissars were Jews. All Jews were commissars. All commissars were Jews, became the elision, with the consequence that Jews became fair game, and by the summer, in a very systematic and organized way, they were being killed executed. Mm. And it soon was the ghettos being rounded up, the men, the women and the children and the babies being taken into the forest where there were trenches very often, and had their clothes and their possessions removed, lined up in front of the trenches and mown down. These are unspeakable stories. And it happened across the whole front. And, you know, there are accurate stories, without any doubt, of, you know, babies being thrown up in the air and bayoneted or shot at in the air as if they were clay pigeons. Mm. And this was done with the connivance of the senior Wehrmacht commanders, despite their post-war denials. Not every single one of them knew very much. Some just averted their gaze. Some ordinary troops were directly involved, marshalling. No less significantly, they were supported, the Einsatzgruppen, Himmler's gangs, who were incidentally, to a large measure, educated people. These weren't thugs taken out of prison. These were people, many of them university graduates, who knew exactly what they were about. They were supported across the whole of the front, from the Balkans down to the Baltic, by large, significant numbers of the indigenous population. There were militia who supported them, there were police who supported them, and there were gangs who supported them. There were those, it has to be said also, because this is today very contentious, of course, in Ukraine and particularly in Poland, there were those who went out of their way to try and protect the Jews, non-Jews in Poland, Catholics who did their best to support, but a very significant number of Poles, Ukrainians, Latvians, across the whole front, were heavily engaged and participating in the systematic start of the Holocaust. And by the end of that year, by the end of 1941, of the some 6 million or so Jews, in addition to whom there were, you know, the quotes undesirables, who were killed, murdered during the war, 1 million at least of those were killed in 1941. A lot of people think the Holocaust began with Auschwitz, didn't it? Yes. Auschwitz was just in the throes of being built, and at the very end of 1941, the first Jews were being shot in Auschwitz.
The numbers in this conflict are staggering. We're talking about millions of deaths. At this scale, it can be hard to grasp the suffering. Was this a challenge for you as an historian?
The losses on the battlefield are absolutely staggering.
Yeah.
They dwarf the killing and the dying on the Western Front, which is not in any way to deprecate those who fought heroically on the Western Front, but the scale of the killing, the best estimate of German casualties in the first 6 months of the war on the Eastern Front is over 1 million. Soviet casualties at least four times that, more than 4 million. Of the 3 million Soviet soldiers who were taken into captivity, where they were tortured, starved, executed, if they survived the journey, many, many of them didn't. The total number was 3 million, 2 million of whom were taken prisoner in 1941.
Yeah.
These beggar belief, these figures, in comparison with any other struggle on any other front ever.
And it's hard to, as I said, it's hard to grasp. How is it to work with this kind of source material as you've been doing and to immerse yourself in this kind of extraordinary, depressing way of looking at life?
It is, you do, when you're doing it, there's part of you that says, why am I doing this? I mean, I don't need to do it in a way. I'm well into retirement age for most people. I happen to have a very young family, two young girls just at secondary school. And I would, at the end of the day's writing, I'm back with my family again. But my real world through much of the time, some of which, of course, was during the pandemic lockdown, COVID lockdown, my real world was 1941. I was living in 1941 and coming into an artificial world, which is the world I really much preferred. And I did it, and I had to keep telling myself, why do I do it? Or why have I done it? And I'd done it because I really think we mustn't be allowed to forget it. Now, other people have written about this period. Other people write about the Second World War, and they, some of them do it absolutely superbly. You know, I'm in the same vineyard seeking to pluck grapes, if you like. And I do it because I think every generation has to keep re-examining it, re-looking at it, not because we fear the same thing's going to happen again. I don't believe it can or would. Warfare would be of a totally different character. But the underlying attitudes which bring about disaster can so easily re-emerge. The idea that history stopped with the end of the Second World War in this context, when you look back at the history of Europe, and the fracturing that is already in many respects taking place in Europe, you need to look at that with a cold eye that can, I think, be better informed by having a strong sense of what happened in the past, which is why I do take it from 1922 through until 1941. And actually, I sort of got briefly to the end of the war as well. It is painful. I mean, it's self-indulged, but it's hard graft. In any case, writing a long book is very hard graft. And you want to be able to write it so that it can be read, that it, you know, isn't a clunky read. So that's, those technical things are important, but the grasping the material, a huge source material available, and you're plucking all the time to construct. You're putting together your own jigsaw puzzle, which you hope makes sense.
And on that, is there an alternative history of the Second World War in which Hitler chooses not to invade? What might that have looked like?
If the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact had held, which didn't involve the Soviet Union fighting with the Nazis, it involved them not fighting and coming to their support if something happened in the territory that they'd both agreed was to be shared between them. What would it have been? Well, you'd have had Britain, the United States, Hitler's hubris, I'm sure, in coming in to the war after the Japanese did Pearl Harbor, Hitler declared war. I think that would probably have happened, and that there was no possibility that the confrontation between the Americans and the Japanese would not have occurred. That was fundamental, but very direct American interests and Japanese interests. So you could have had a situation in which you have that confrontation, and at that point, my imagination runs out, because would it have been possible most of the forces in 1944-45, huge majority were on the Eastern Front, not on the Western Front. It is hard to see how the Western Front could have been greater in numbers of people. It was the greatest seaborne invasion, D-Day. There were long logistic lines from the United States across the Atlantic. It is quite possible that the German U-boat fleets would have recovered from their destruction in 1943 with better U-boats, which would have made those lifelines much easier to sever. They'd become impossible to sever by 1944, which is crucial to D-Day. It is perfectly possible to imagine, therefore, that that Germany would have had absolute control of Europe and could have forced Britain into a very difficult situation indeed by blockading effectively Britain. Would the United States have been able to assist? Would the United States have assisted? These are frightening imponderables.
You're right that the last 6 months of 1941 were of greater moment than any other period in the 20th century. So this was a period that not only shaped the outcome of the war, but the path of European politics for generations. How?
Well, at the end of 1941, Anthony Eden, British Foreign Secretary, arrived. It coincided with the Germans halting their attack and beginning their retreat from Moscow. So he was able to go and see a little bit of the retaken territory. He met Stalin and was impressed by Stalin, and he came away believing at the time there that it was absolutely vital to do a deal with Stalin there and then about the future of Europe, rather than waiting until Stalin could dictate terms. Churchill would have none of that. We don't negotiate till the end of the war, which is also Roosevelt's view, although Roosevelt at that point, you know, just at the beginning of Roosevelt coming into the war, and Churchill was in Washington. He'd gone to Washington immediately after Pearl Harbor. And therefore, that was off the agenda. And Eden was told so by Churchill in early 1942 in no uncertain terms. What we see is increasingly confident, not desperate demands from Stalin for a second front. Once the German retreat begins, and you reach 1943 and Tehran, the conference in Tehran, in effect, the Western Allies had to or decided to give to Stalin, in effect, Eastern Europe. You know, there were disputes still over Poland, which would go on, but there was never any doubt that Stalin could have Poland if he wanted it, which Churchill later recognised. So the question then became, how far? Because by this time, the Germans were going to be defeated. By 1943, no one could have believed otherwise, a question of when. And the possibility, therefore, existed very, very strongly that Stalin could simply say, well, we're going to come west as far as we want unless you say we can't. So at those negotiations at Tehran and afterwards, the West was actually on the defensive, trying to protect as much territory for the Western interests as possible. The fortitude, the resilience, the ability of the Western Allies to fight, to establish D-Day was an astonishing achievement. Then they fought, and it was a relentless and difficult struggle, and no one should do other than hold in the highest regard what they achieved. But I don't think that they achieved quite what we like to believe. We like to believe, I mean, I'm talking about traditional British education and Western education, that we beat Hitler as a result of D-Day. Actually, what we did was to make sure that Western Europe could not be seized by Stalin without there being a major confrontation, because we controlled Berlin westwards. And that was pretty fundamentally important. And it was also, it was sort of not quite overt, but it was known that that was the case by the political classes in the West. And that was, you know, heroically important that that was done, incidentally, for those of us who treasure freedom and democracy and the rule of law, rather than the oppression that the people of Eastern Europe had until finally the collapse of the Soviet Union, with all the uncertainties. So I think if you're looking at today in Europe, at the very most recent, you have to look back to what happened in the war and see that the Soviet Union had made those huge conquests of victory in the Second World War. And they still deeply resent the failure of the West, as they see it, to properly recognize the scale of the contribution on the Eastern Front. Historically, they can't understand why the West won't accept that Crimea belongs to the Russians. Crimea was, a large part of Crimea was Russian for a very, very long time. They can't understand why we should care so much about the Baltic states or about Ukraine. Historically, those were the borders of the Russian Empire. The Soviet Union died, soldiers of the Soviet Union died in their millions to protect that, and we are an aggressive Western trespasser on their soil. And that's a psychological, it's not the sort of the nitty-gritty of the political struggle that there is always going on below the surface. It is the psychological standpoint from which Putin derives a lot of his authority inside the Russian state, despite everything that is deplorable that he manages to achieve there.
Jonathan Dimbleby, thank you very much.
My great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to History Lessons with Matthias Hisseris. This episode was produced by Mary Jassel, with script by Oliver Rhodes and recorded in London by SNK Studios. History Lessons is brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. Stay tuned for more episodes featuring leading historians here on Engelsberg Ideas.